War has played a key role in the history of the United States, from the nation's founding right down to the present. War made the U.S. independent, kept it together, increased its size, and established it as a global superpower. Understanding America's wars is essential for understanding American history. Welcome to Key Battles of American History, a podcast in which we discuss American history through the lens of the most important battles of America's wars. Here is your host, James Early.
Hello and welcome to another episode of The Pacific War on Film. This week, Sean and I are discussing another classic, another very old movie, a movie that was actually made during the war when the war was still going on. And that is the movie 30 Seconds Over Tokyo, made in 1944. This is a movie about the Doolittle Raid. And I have to stop and say that as I record this, it is pouring down rain outside in Houston. And there's thunder and lightning. So, folks, if you hear thunder in the background, that's why. You might hear it. Who knows? It's pretty darn loud. But anyway, before we get into the plot, let's talk about, as we always do, some of the basics of the movie. The movie is 2 hours and 15 minutes long. That's our third one in a row, Sean. That's over 2 hours.
Which, that's long for a 1944 movie.
Yeah, exactly. It's long even today, but especially then. Very highly rated movie on Rotten Tomatoes. The critics gave it 100%. Sean, we should have a bell go off, like ding, or a trumpet blast.
It's one of the few out there.
I don't think we've ever done one that was 100% so far. But the audience gave it 75%. I don't know. That may be because it's black and white, because it's older. Mm-hmm. It's kind of got some of that 1940s cheesy sentimentality. But nevertheless, I tend to go more with the critics. I think it's a delightful movie. It's got a rating of average rating of 7.3 on IMDb, which is respectable. The director is Mervyn LeRoy, which that is probably not a household name among people now, even people that like movies. But I'm sure Sean will talk about this later. But he has actually directed some other movies that you've probably seen. And I know you've heard of some of these actors, at least two of them. It stars Spencer Tracy, Van Johnson, Robert Walker, Phyllis Thaxter, and Robert Mitchum, a very young Robert Mitchum. Mm-hmm. It was nominated for 2 Academy Awards, Best Special Effects, which it won. Duh, of course. The effects are incredible, especially for 1944 standards. It's just amazing. It was also nominated for Best Black and White Cinematography. It did not win that award, but hey, it was nominated, so that's pretty impressive. And it was recognized as an inspirational patriotic film with great value as a morale builder for wartime audiences. Later reviewers have considered 30 Seconds Over Tokyo the finest aviation film of the period. And another tremendous compliment is the fact that the actual Doolittle Raiders considered it a worthy tribute. All right, going to you, Sean.
Yeah, so the film is based on, it's an MGM film, so we've actually seen MGM pictures before, but it is based on a book that was written by Ted Lawson, who is the real-life Doolittle Raider who Van Johnson plays in the film, and Robert Considine, who is a journalist who helped him write the book. And it's based on Ted Lawson's firsthand recounting of the events. The book was published in mid-1943, and this was after the details of the raid were declassified. That before that, the War Department controlled very strictly the information about where the attack was staged from. And there's a most famous quip from FDR in 1942, shortly right after the raid, when he was asked where they flew from, and he said, "Why, from Shangri-La," which was the fictional land in the Himalayas in the book and the film, The Land of Time Forgotten, I believe. Is that the one? Is that the book?
I don't know.
Don't even remember. But it was anyway. And actually, famously, the Navy did have an Essex class aircraft carrier that they named Shangri-La in honor of that. So,
and that was also that was the original name of Camp David, too.
Yes. Yeah. It's a famous story. So, as you said, Mervyn LeRoy was the director. He was one of the studio directors originally at Warner Brothers, and then later he was at MGM. He probably is most famous as he was the producer who helped organize the set and the production for The Wizard of Oz. So He also directed At the Circus, which is a Marx Brothers comedy, which is, if you've not seen any Marx Brothers movies, go out and watch some of the early 1930s and 40s Marx Brothers movies. Among his most famous films, this is his most famous film, probably. And he also directed Quo Vadis, which is a Bible movie from the 1950s.
Oh, that's a great flick.
Yeah. And then we will cover a film that he actually participated in. He wasn't the main director, but he did step in to finish a little movie called Mr. Roberts for John Ford. John Ford had a habit of injuring himself. And so he ruptured a gallbladder during the filming of Mr. Roberts. And so Mervyn LeRoy came in to help him finish some of the productions. And he had produced and directed Henry Fonda in the stage production of it in 1948. So, and actually another really good one you should check out. It's a really good, it's sort of a war movie, but it's not really a war movie because there's no war, but it's a real famous movie called No Time for Sergeants. And it's really where people first learned who Andy Griffin was. And if you've never seen that one, James, you got to go see that one. It's absolutely hilarious because he kind of plays a Gomer Pyle type character who gets drafted to the Air Force. And he's just sort of a aw shucks kind of country boy. And it's very funny. Very, very funny. And actually, Don Knotts is in a scene as a trying to give the Andy Griffith character a psychological profile. And so if you're a fan of Mayberry, you definitely should check out No Time for Sergeants. The author, the screenwriter for the movie was a gentleman named Dalton Trumbo. And if you don't know anything about Dalton Trumbo probably is most famous. He was a famous film writer, but he was most famous for being blacklisted during the McCarthy era. And actually, LeRoy was blacklisted as well. He had some pretty strong socialist beliefs, and he was blacklisted for those associations with communists. But Dalton Trumbo was definitely blacklisted, and he famously was able to be reinstated to Hollywood because of the screenplay that he wrote for the very famous and movie that we'll also be watching, and that's The Bridge on the River Kwai. So just a little bit about Dalton Trumbo and about the production of this film. The film is known for its accurate depiction of aerial combat. And so they actually use real B-25 C and D models. And so the models, the design that was used in the raid was the B model of the B-25. And it's, you can tell because it's got the turret and the dorsal turret on the back of the airplane, the top of the airplane. It's further back towards the tail. And later model B-25s, they move that turret further up so it could be used to shoot forward, because they kind of shifted the B-25 in the middle of the war to be a low-level attack aircraft more than a high-level medium bomber, especially in the Pacific. And so what they did with the later B-25s is they stuck machine guns on the side of the nose. They called them chin guns. They had that turret that was further at the front so it could fire over the cockpit. And then even they stuffed the nose with as many machine guns as they could fit, and in some cases, 75-millimeter cannon. So the B-25 H's and J's could actually sink a destroyer, Japanese destroyer, with just their machine guns. But at any rate, they used close models to the actual aircraft used in the raid. Most later depictions of the raid that you'll see in movies will use late model B-25s, and they were more commonly available today. A lot of the late model B-25s were turned into executive transports and other things after the war. So those are the ones that you find you see those at air shows and things like that. You don't see many of the older models. So that's why this one's kind of unique, because this was made during the war. So they had plenty of those earlier models available. They didn't have a carrier when they filmed the movie, because all of those carriers that were available were fighting the Japanese. So, and the Hornet.
Well, the Hornet had been sunk, right?
Yeah, it was sunk at the Battle of Santa Cruz. Yeah. Right. So they did have an accurate set that they built, sort of like we saw in the movie Tora, 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 where they built a very large set to double for the Hornet and her deck, with the B-25s lashed to it as they're filming scenes on the deck of the Hornet. They also use actual footage from the raid. And this footage from the raid, especially the takeoff scene, and then actual footage of Japanese aircraft attacking them, and footage of the Japanese countryside rolling by and bombs hitting the factories in Tokyo that they bombed, that's actual footage from the raid that was taken from cameras filmed inside the aircraft, as well as on the aircraft carrier. And actually, this helps preserve the quality of that newsreel footage, because that newsreel footage was filmed in a different stock, and it's degraded even by the early 70s. I've seen footage and pictures from books, and the quality straight from the newsreel footage is really bad. I mean, it's already grainy, even in some of my 1970s and 80s World War II books and documentary stuff. So, but because they transferred it to 35-millimeter film for the film itself, itself, then some of that footage is really well, relatively well preserved. It hasn't degraded as much. So Spencer Tracy, as you said, is the star. He has top billing, but he actually isn't in the film very much. He has a very small part. Van Johnson is really the lead.
Tracy just kind of pops in and out every now and then.
Yeah, yeah, he does. But Johnson and Tracy had done a movie the previous year. It was a very famous aviation film called A Guy Named Joe. And if you've ever seen the Steven Spielberg movie in the 1980s, Always, with Richard Dreyfuss and John Goodman and Holly Hunter, that is based on the World War II film, A Guy Named Joe. And Spencer Tracy plays a pilot who killed, but his ghost is helping a younger pilot and his girlfriend kind of get together. And Van Johnson, that was Van Johnson's really breakthrough film. The aerial effects coordinators for A Guy Named Joe also did the aerial effects for 30 Seconds Over Tokyo. And the film was a big hit. It was a very effective as a wartime morale booster. And like you said, it's considered one of the finest aviation films of its time. It's actually considered one of the very best masterpieces of the war era. It is considered a masterpiece, and it's one of the best films released during the war era. Most people rank it pretty very highly up there with Mrs. Miniver and a few of the, and Casablanca, as really the very best of the best of the war films. So Good movie. So let's talk about it.
Let's do it. So the first part, as is often true in a lot of these war movies, is a training scene, a series of scenes in training. The opening title says 131 days after December 7th, 1941, a handful of young men who had never dreamed of glory struck the first blow at the heart of Japan. This is their true story we tell here. I had to use my best newsreel announcer voice there. But anyway, and then, so we start out, we see Lieutenant Colonel James Doolittle, played by Spencer Tracy, as we've seen. He orders that 24 volunteer B-25 crews fly to Eglin Field, which is in Florida. They are not to be told the nature of their mission, other than that it is dangerous. And then we see one crew led by Lieutenant Ted Lawson, of course, played by Van Johnson, as Sean already said, flying in. They and other flyers there, you know, they all arrive and they all sit around and they speculate on the nature of their mission. They're trying to figure out, what are we doing? Do you know? No, do you know? They're always saying, what's the dope? What's the dope? That's that must have been a big phrase. That and swell. Both of those appear in both this movie and the movie we did last time.
They're code approved.
Yeah, really, no kidding. And they unwind a little bit. They drink and dance. And what cracks me up is they sing "The Eyes of Texas," and then they sing "Deep in the Heart of Texas." And in fact, yeah, they're gonna sing "Deep in the Heart of Texas" about three or four times in this movie. And it cracks me up. There's one character that they call Shorty, and he's really tall, of course, and he's some kind of Southerner. I didn't pick up on what state he was. I guess he's from Texas. He's always talking about Texas, but. Finally, Doolittle arrives at the camp and he tells the men about the importance of secrecy. He tells them the training will be tough, gives them the chance to drop out. And of course, nobody does. And the men head to their planes for an orientation flight. Did you want to talk more about Van Johnson?
Yeah, Van Johnson is actually one of my favorite of those old Hollywood actors from that period. He was a major star in the war years because he's a real nice looking guy. He's a good looking guy. He had a very pleasant demeanor, and he had a real everyman feel about him. Actually, there was a film that didn't do well because he kind of played a heel and it didn't work because he's just a smiling kind of guy. He later appeared, he appeared in a bunch of war movies. And it's odd because he appeared in movies about the war, after the war, but also during the war. Well, the reason was that he was in these movies. He's a young guy. He's under 30. So you're like, why is he in this movie when, you know, Jimmy Stewart and Clark Gable are flying bombing missions, you know, over Germany? Well, and Ted Williams, baseball player, is a Marine Corps pilot flying, you know, Corsairs. So the reason why he was not in military service was he had a serious car accident during the filming of A Guy Named Joe. And it was very, very bad accident. They actually had to stop production for 4 months to let him heal. But he had a metal plate put in his skull. So, you know, this was in 1942, 43. So he wasn't, you know, at the time when he probably would have been ready to be drafted or volunteer because the pressure was on to join, he couldn't serve because he had a metal plate. So it helped him in his immediate career because he was available for all these films, right? He's become an A-lister because of A Guy Named Joe. It was a big hit. So he's able to be in all these movies Robert Mitchum was also a young guy. He was of age to serve, but he was exempted because before the war, before he became an actor, he had a job at the Lockheed plant and he suffered hearing damage from the engines running in the plant. And so he had a young family too. So he had a family exemption, but also he had a medical exemption. So a lot of the guys that you'll see that didn't serve in the war, but were of age to have served, generally speaking, they probably have some type of reason why they can't serve. And a lot of it was medical. Some of them were too thin. Like Jimmy Stewart was almost too thin to be able to go into the military. He had to gain weight, and they had to slip some money to the Army induction folks to allow him to join in the first place.
Huh, shades of JFK.
yeah, really it was. I mean, it's true. Yeah, he weighed about 140 pounds. Which that's crazy to me, but
Of us, that's our right leg, you know?
yeah. But for Jimmy Stewart, 6'1" or 6'2", that's a big deal. So anyway, Van Johnson, I really like Van. He's in a great, great, great movie about the Atlantic, the European theater called Battleground. It's about the Battle of the Bulge. And he's really wonderful in that. And you've seen him. We'll see him again later on in our series. He's in the Caine Mutiny. So we'll see him again.
Right. Yeah. And he's definitely he's got a baby face, and he's just kind of got this gee whiz, aw shucks, you know, kind of nature. And I appreciate about this is that the guys are about the right age. You know, some of the movies that we're going to be discussing, they're just too old.
Yeah.
You know, here's a guy who's a lieutenant junior grade and he's 45 or something. You know, it's like, what? Spencer Tracy, I looked it up, was in his early to mid 40s about this time, which was right.
Yeah, Tracy would have been too ill to serve. And he did have a family also.
But he was the right age to be Doolittle. And Johnson and Robert Mitchum were both like 25-ish. And that's about right for a lieutenant.
Yeah. So we'll talk about Spencer Tracy and his performance as Doolittle at the end.
Yeah. All right. So moving on, let's see. Lieutenant Lawson is greeted by his wife, Ellen, who is played by actress that's not super famous named Phyllis Thaxter. Ellen has surprised him by coming to Eglin. Dawson, while flying the orientation mission, reads a letter from Ellen in which she tells him she's pregnant. Later that day, Lawson and Ellen spend a quiet evening together. You know, there's some nice, really touching romantic parts between them, and they're a little bit syrupy and cheesy, so, but it's typical 40s fare.
Yeah, my wife and I laughed because they talk about her being pregnant, but then like there's their beds, they have two twin beds. And we laughed about that, it was the code of the time. So,
Lucy and Ricky would be proud.
I did explain, you just couldn't even have the notion that, and he didn't say pregnant. She says expecting,
right.
And he says, I'm going to be a father. So
yeah.
The Hollywood code was very, very, very strict back in that time.
Yeah, I guess the stork brought it or something.
Exactly.
And I'm going to pull a Sean here. I actually did a little research on Phyllis Thaxter. She wasn't in a ton of movies. She was in her career was in about maybe 20 total movies, which may sound like a lot, but it's nothing compared to some of the people we've been discussing. No. John Wayne was like in hundreds or something, but most of her movies were, in fact, this was her debut movie. This was the first movie she appeared in. It was also Robert Mitchum's first movie. And most of her movies were between 1944 and 1957. So she just kind of stepped away. But she came back in 1978 as Ma Kent in Superman 1, one of my all-time favorite movies.
Oh, yes, she was Ma Kent. I forgot about that.
Yep. That, to me, that's the most famous one. I'd never heard of any of these other movies. I'm sure you've seen probably 10 of them.
Who knows? She is a pretty obscure actress. But
yeah. I mean,
she was popular, but she wasn't Lana Turner or anything.
All right. Well, the next day, Doolittle briefs the men. He tells them it's likely that some of them will be shot down on their mission. Because of this, their Norden bomb sites will be removed. We talked about that in one of my battles episodes, but the Norden bomb site was kind of like a primitive little mini computer. It wasn't just like a really cool telescope. You know, I mean, it actually took control of the plane for a while.
Norden was a strange dude. So
yeah, and it was a heavily guarded secret, and they didn't want to even take any chance at all that it would fall. One of them, not even one, would fall into the hands of the Japanese.
Now, not to go down a rabbit trail, but I can't remember. Did in this film did they show the substitute bomb site that they used?
They did. I remember seeing one scene. I was just rewatching it yesterday. I don't know what it was called, but
it's a very simple. They called it like. like a 2 cent thing or a 10 cent, you know, site, but it's basically a very simple, I think a quarter wheel, a metal wheel with just an adjustable bar on it. And it's just a line of sight, bomb sight, but they weren't going to be flying at high altitude. They were going to be coming in at treetop. So they didn't need really very much.
Right.
And plus the Norton was quite heavy. So that saved on a lot of weight that they did have to cut down on the weight on the aircraft.
Yeah, they took out a lot of things, and they don't show a lot of that in this movie. They showed some of that in the Pearl Harbor movie with the broomsticks painted black and stuff. But anyway, so the next day, lo and behold, a Navy lieutenant shows up. Remember, these are Army pilots. But here comes a Navy lieutenant teaching them how to take off from a 500-foot runway. Remember, they still don't know what they're doing. And all they must have been a little surprised. So here's this Navy lieutenant. And why do we have to take off in 500 feet? That's much less than they normally would. He also teaches them about naval etiquette, but again, they're not told why. And the crews begin making trial runs, and they can't do it the first few times, but they get better. Lawson tries one time, and he scrapes his plane's tail on the ground. And somebody says, I think it's Shorty, says his plane looks like a ruptured duck, and the name sticks. And that becomes the name of the plane, the ruptured duck, complete with a picture of a cartoon duck on the plane's nose. That's kind of funny. And later, Lawson and his crew successfully do take off within 500 feet. Did you want to comment on that?
No, I think... I can't remember if it was in the film. It's been a couple of weeks since I watched this. I can't remember if it was in the film or if this really happened, but because I've always read that Doolittle, you know, the men were griping at him that was impossible, and he went out and did it.
Right.
He just did it to show him. But Jimmy Doolittle was a unique character. He was the most famous pilot in America for a reason. You know, he's the first person to ever do an outside loop. He'd won the racing trophy. He'd set speed records. So, you know, he was picked for this for a reason, because they knew that he was the most qualified experimental pilot in the entire Army Air Corps. So.
James here. And now a brief word from our sponsors. So then they have an emotional farewell party at which everyone is singing, guess what? Deep in the Heart of Texas, plus other songs. Auld Lang Syne is one of them. And then the men are called to a meeting in the middle of the night. It's like 3 a.m. and Doolittle tells them that they're going to be, finally tells them the first place they're going to go, and that's Alameda Field in California. They're going to fly at hedgehopping altitude, which is low altitude. There to contact no one. And Lawson says goodbye to Ellen. It's a very emotional farewell scene because he knows he might not be coming back. So that's the first part. That's the training part. Yep. Shall we move on to part two, preparation? All right, let's do it. Preparation. Lawson and his crew arrive at Alameda. They cross under the San Francisco Bay Bridge, and all the B-25s are loaded onto the carrier USS Hornet. And that's another kind of like...
Yeah, with cranes. They were not happy that the planes were picked up with big cranes.
They're going, what? It reminds me of in Midway. We're going to talk about the movie Midway 2019 next week, and there's this one part where Dickie says, what the hell are they Army planes doing on a carrier? He has this ridiculously exaggerated fake Southern accent. But yeah. Anyway, but not in this movie. The Army flyers are shown to their quarters. Lawson talks with one of his crewmen, Corporal Thatcher, you know, a trope of these kind of movies before the mission. You know, what do you want to do after the war? You know, where do you go? Oh, I might do this. What about you? I don't know. I might do this. Yeah. He also talks to Bill. What's Mitchum's character's name?
Bob Gray.
Bob Gray. Yeah, Bob.
That was his best friend. In real life.
To say Bill Gray. That's my karate instructor.
Yeah, that was his best friend, his best man at his wedding, as a matter of fact. So,
right.
Bob Gray was a real character. I like this scene because when they get on the Hornet and they all get lost in the...
Yeah,
walking around the ship. He goes up a stairwell and winds up like with a locked door and then a hatch and then he's just wandering around. And of course, and then they said something about there's like all cigarettes out and he goes to smoke. And one of a young sailor's like, sir, no smoking. We're fueling planes. So no smoking.
Yeah, the smoking light is off. Yeah,
smoking light is off. So Robert Walker is another really great actor who's in this film. He was a very, very talented young actor. And he actually most famously appeared five or six years later in the Hitchcock movie, Strangers on a Train, where he meets another guy and they get to talking about their problems with some women. He with his mother and this other character with his girlfriend. The other person is Farley Granger. And they basically kind of swap murders and it's the whole film is about that. And it's, he's a complete sociopath in the film, and he's very creepy. But interestingly, Farley Granger played a POW on trial in Japan in a film that was inspired by the Do the Little Raid called Purple Heart. And it was released the same year as 30 Seconds Over Tokyo. So it's interesting. These two characters that were later in a Hitchcock movie were characters playing Doolittle Raiders, basically during the war. Walker was a person who wasn't, he was, I think, too thin and had some health problems and wasn't able to serve in the army. He suffered from mental illness throughout most of his life, and he died at the age of 32, just a few years later, after being over-sedated by a psychiatrist. So he didn't have a very long career. He's just really well known for Strangers on a Train and for this film and a few other films. And his son, if you're a Star Trek fan from the original series, Charlie X, Robert Walker Jr. plays him. So that was his son. His son looked just like him. And he's in an episode of Star Trek, the original series. So if you're watching 30 Seconds Over Tokyo and you're like, how did this guy get in 20 years later in a Star Trek episode? Well, it's his son that was a lookalike.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Well, the next morning, the army personnel are summoned to the wardroom, and there Doolittle finally tells them exactly what they're going to do. He says they're going to bomb Tokyo, Yokohama, Osaka, Kobe, and Nagoya. They will land after that at designated places in China and regroup in Chongqing. And I should mention that they're going to try to get to as close to Japan as possible, but they're not going to be able to return to the carriers. And that's why the plan is to land in friendly Chinese territory. Chongqing was the temporary capital, where the capital was Nanking. Wasn't it Nanking at the time? It wasn't Peking or Beijing.
Yeah,
that was Nanking.
It was Nanking.
Evacuate from there because of the Japanese took it over.
Nanjing is the Panyin.
Nanjing in modern terminology. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was never the intention to land on the carriers.
Right.
The three possible aircraft that they could have used, one of them was the A-20. It didn't have enough range. The B-25 and the B-26. The B-26, there was no way they could take it off in less than 500 feet. The B-25 was the only one they could conceivably take off in 25 feet and carry a reasonably useful bomb load. And here's the thing. These weren't B-29s, you know, a fleet of B-29s dropping thousands of tons of bombs on these cities. This was to be a pinprick raid, but it was to be symbolic. That was the intention of the raid. It was not to cause, they knew it wouldn't cause super serious damage. But what they knew is to show that they could strike the Japanese. And it was entirely a propaganda strike. And that's, Doolittle knew this. And the raiders knew this as well. But it was entirely symbolic.
Yes. And Doolittle says anyone can still drop out if they wish. He gives them one more chance to bow out. Nobody does.
He says it won't be held against them either.
Right. And the next day, the men are given instructions for takeoff, and they're told if a plane malfunctions, it will be pushed over the side of the carrier. They don't have time to fix anything. It's just they got to hurry. So the men are given their targets. They're warned not to land in Japanese-controlled areas. If the Japanese have taken their assigned landing strip, they're to keep going until they run out of gas and ditch their planes. And true to form, Doolittle will personally lead the attack. He was not the kind of a lead from behind kind of guy. He was right up there in the front, in the thick of things.
Well, and he will have the least runway on that aircraft carrier, too.
Yeah, he's in number one position.
Yeah.
Dawson and his friend, Lieutenant Bob Gray, who we just discussed, another pilot played by Robert Mitchum, they talk about how they don't dislike the Japanese. You know, they're just doing a job. And they speculate about how many of their pilots and their crews will survive. And they discuss future plans. Shall we talk about Robert Mitchum?
I mean, what can you say about Robert Mitchum?
I know. He's just like an icon. He's almost not quite in the category of John Wayne, but he'd be right below, you know?
Well, I mean, and actually they were in a film together where he played a drunk sidekick to John Wayne. So, but no, he's the classic, you know, film noir actor, you know, the classic Philip Marlowe character. So, I mean, but he's very young here, very young and handsome and but still he still has that Bob Mitchum toughness look about him. So
yeah, that baritone voice. And
yeah, the Bob Mitchum voice.
He would go on to do, gosh, Cape Fear, and he's in other war movies too. He was in the 1976 Midway. He played Halsey.
Yes, he did play Halsey.
You know what I remember him? My first experience with Robert Mitchum was The Winds of War and War and Remembrance.
Yes.
You know, those Winds of War came out my freshman year in high school, and I watched every minute of it. It was a long, like an 18-hour miniseries. And
yeah, it was on ABC, I think.
Yeah, and Warren Remembrance was maybe 2 or 3 years later. He was way too old for his role at that time. He was like 65 playing a captain in the Navy. You know, I think in the book he was 50. I read the books too, but yeah, Robert Mitchum, we could do a whole show just on his career. What a career. Oh. It's fun to see him in his very first role, you know, and he's just a kid, but he's still got that swagger, you know, and that gravitas even as such a young man. All right. Well, Doolittle tells the men to only hit military targets, but he allows that hitting civilians is inevitable. There's no way they can avoid it. He tells them also not to drop their gas cans one at a time, but to save them all until they are empty. And that way there's no trail of gas cans back to the Hornet. They don't want a trail of breadcrumbs, so to speak, leading the Japanese right back to the Hornet. The Hornet wants to live to fight another day. He again offers to let anyone drop out who wants to. And again, of course, no one does. And then he tells him he's proud to serve with them. All right. Then we run into a minor problem, actually a huge problem.
Yeah.
This wasn't supposed to happen. They were supposed to get much closer to the Japanese home islands, but the task force sights a Japanese ship. And of course, they have to attack it and destroy it.
Yeah, it's a picket. I believe it was a picket ship of some kind. Yeah.
Yeah. They don't want, obviously, they can't allow it to report back to.
Yeah. The Japanese use fishing vessels out on the ocean as sort of patrol picket ships.
Yeah. And they don't know if it may have spotted them or may not. And if it did spot them, it may have notified Tokyo. So they got to get rid of the ship. And even more importantly, they've got to go ahead and launch. They're 650 miles away. And that's going to give them less room to land. In other words, they're not going to be able to go as far into China as they'd hoped to. The air crews are ordered to their planes. The pilots, led by Doolittle, take off, and Doolittle has no trouble. Lawson's crew, Ted Lawson, the main character, again, Van Johnson is the actor, they're seventh in line. And one of their engines does not work at first. It's just kind of, you know, the classic thing. And the Navy crew is moving up, and they're getting ready to shove the plane overboard. But then finally, at the last minute, the engine kicks in, and they take off. And I don't know if that was true or not. Do you know, Sean, or was that just...
Lawson was a consultant on the film.
Yeah.
So it's entirely possible that may have happened. These weren't, you know, these are piston engine World War II aircraft, so they could be finicky whenever they wanted to be. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think that... So I do believe that the Japanese did get the message that the ships were out there, but they didn't get a full message of what they were or what they were doing.
Right.
And so they were still several hundred miles away from a safety zone of what the Japanese would have expected aircraft carriers to fly off their strike so that they could recover their aircraft. Right. So the Japanese didn't take it seriously. They thought maybe they were headed for another island or they were still coming. So they had time. They had several days before. Because, you know, the aircraft carriers, they go, you know, 20, 30 miles an hour. You know, it's going to be a while before they're in a place that they can launch aircraft. So that was the whole idea. But they did take off sooner because they were worried that the Japanese would send submarines or something after the carriers. So the carriers wasn't just Hornet. It was also Enterprise. Enterprise had all of the Navy aircraft on it, so that it could defend the whole task force, because while the B-25s were on Hornet's deck, there was no other aircraft that they could launch and especially recover. So someone had to defend the whole task force. So they had cruisers, they had destroyers, they had Enterprise. So two of the four aircraft carriers in the Pacific at that time were going towards Japan, the most dangerous place that they could possibly be.
Yeah. Enterprise, commanded by Admiral Halsey, I should mention in passing.
Right.
Whom Robert Mitchum would magically turn into 30 years later.
Yeah.
All right. So now we get to the mission. And this is a fairly short sequence, but it is incredible. The planes fly at low altitude toward Japan. When they reach Japanese waters, they pass several boats and the crew members just wave at them. They don't really realize, I don't think, that they're Americans.
Yeah.
I mean, why would they? Why would there be American planes this close to Japan?
Well, and the thing is that, first of all, those crew members probably had never seen an American aircraft.
Right.
I mean, we thought that the Japanese aircraft attacking Pearl Harbor were Americans. So.
Right. Yeah.
And remember that at the time in 1942, American aircraft, we have the roundel, the blue roundel with the white star in the middle, but in the middle of the white star is a red circle. Mm. And so that caused a lot of confusion because the Japanese symbol is just the red circle. Mm-hmm. And so if you're not really looking or it kind of blends in with the camouflage, you really only see that red. And by the middle of 1942, actually, by the time of Midway, I believe, they had removed the red roundel from the middle of the American insignia. So because they were seeing American aircraft get shot down.
Yeah. And so they're going along, and then they run into some Japanese planes flying overhead, and Corporal Thatcher is just about ready to blast him, but he doesn't, and they just fly right overhead. They don't attack. Finally, Lawson and his crew, as well as the other planes, they reach their target, they drop their bombs, and they hit their targets. Six more Zeros appear, but they also do not attack. So the mission was, as Sean said, it's not a huge bombing raid. It's not going to do a ton of damage. It's symbolic, but it's successful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's really, this is the key sequence of the film. It's not that long, but it is so exciting. And, you know, it's been pretty much copied by every movie since then about the Doolittle Raid, almost verbatim, other than, you know, Ben Affleck in being in it in Pearl Harbor. It's pretty much exactly copied in the movie Pearl Harbor. And then in the 2019 Midway movie, it's exactly copied. I mean, they get note for note in the Midway movie. So it's just, to me, this is the height of what you watch this movie for. And in some ways, actually, there's even some elements that appear in other aviation films, like even non-aviation films like Star Wars, the trench run and some of the shots of the pilots in Star Wars, the original Star Wars movie. We know that George Lucas was a big, huge fan of war movies and a pilot of aircraft movies. So I think this is great. And, you know, it also shows the complacency of the Japanese. You know, the crew members of the boats wave, the Japanese fighters, they don't attack. They think they're Japanese aircraft. Who would be here but Japanese aircraft? So this was, you know, we were caught with our pants down at Pearl Harbor. The Japanese were 100% caught with their pants down in the Doolittle Raid.
Right. I agree with you. This is just downright exciting. It's simply amazing for a 1944 movie. The first time I watched it, I was on the edge of my seat. I knew already what was going to happen, but it's just really well done. Just, oh man. And like you said, it just set the standard for so many future movies. I love, it's fun to talk about these older movies because they're the pioneers. They're the ones that established the pattern, you know, established the way things need to be done. I'm a long time ago, we talked about the movie All Quiet on the Western Front and how that set the standard for a lot of war movies,
right?
And ground combat movies. And this does the same for the air.
Right. I mean, it locks everyone's perspective, and there's no two ways about it.
Right. All right. So now after the mission, this is a longer section. Darkness makes it hard for Lawson and his crew to find their destination, and they're running out of fuel. And when their fuel is nearly out, they land. There's a heavy rain. They can barely see, and the crew aims for the beach, but they end up landing in shallow water. And miraculously, none of them are killed. Lawson swims ashore, and he soon finds the rest of the crew. There's five men. They're all alive. Everyone but Thatcher, though, is badly injured. Lawson's left leg is laid open to the bone. McClure's shoulders are broken, and the plane is destroyed.
Yeah, and those injuries, they're pretty gruesome. They're pretty bad.
Yeah, I read that there was one of them, I forget his name, I didn't put it in the notes, who was in the movie was portrayed as like he couldn't even walk. They had to carry him. Who was that? What was his name?
Well, Lawson, definitely.
But it wasn't Lawson. It was another one. But anyway, that guy wasn't hurt that bad in real life.
Well, and Lawson also in real life, I believe Lawson's face, his jaw was shattered.
Yeah, he came through the windscreen, and I read that his teeth were kind of loose, and he started kind of trying to like snap them back into position. Instead, they all came out. So he lost almost all of his teeth. His face was kind of partly crushed. They didn't show that. Obviously, you don't want your, you know, your good looking guy.
Especially one who the year before had that exact thing happen to him. So,
oh, I know. Mm. Yeah. But yeah, so they're in bad, they're not being captured by the Japanese at this point, but they're in bad shape. And fortunately for them, a group of Chinese civilians appears and they take the Americans to their village. Then Chinese soldiers arrive and they give the Americans cigarettes. That's the most important thing we know. Everybody, at least it was for people back then, cigarettes. You got to have the cigarettes. Lawson tells a Chinese soldier who speaks English that they need a doctor. And he also tells the soldiers that they need to go to Chungking. And there's one of the soldiers knows a little bit of English, and so they're able to communicate. But again, they're not in good shape. And the next day, the Chinese soldiers take them to Chinese boats, which are flying Japanese flags. So they're dodging Japanese patrols. And after a long boat ride, they take the Americans over land to a town. The leader of the town, whose name is Fu Ling, greets them. Very kind, very friendly fella. And he tells them that there's no doctor, but hopefully one will arrive. And finally, one does. It's a young man named Dr. Chung, but he has no medical supplies. So Dr. Chung tells them that he will take them to a hospital that's 60. I've got leagues here, but I think it's actually Li. I think a Li is a Chinese unit of measurement.
Yeah, that could maybe be.
They say it's like a Chinese mile. I don't know how long it is, but
yeah, he speaks with a pretty thick accent. So
it's pretty far away though, but they really need to, these guys have got to get some real medical attention. And so they got to move them. Any thoughts on that part, Sean?
No. We'll talk about this in the next film when we talk about Midway, but they pretty much take this entire sequence in the movie Midway. This whole scene, they pretty much copy verbatim.
They just show it from Doolittle's perspective instead of Ted Lawson's.
Yeah, Doolittle actually landed. He was one of the few who landed well. He landed in a rice paddy, and I don't think any of his men had any injuries. And they got away pretty well. There was a couple of planes that actually somehow managed to fly to Russia, and they were interned by the Russians, and the Russians kept B-25s and used them. But they eventually made their way back home. They were lucky ones.
Yeah, we'll talk more about that at the end.
Oh, okay.
I added some extra stuff. That's okay. James here, and now a brief word from our sponsors. So they set out, and there's Japanese forces nipping at their heels, not quite literally, but they're not far behind. Like they say, the village we were just in, the Japanese just took over.
Yeah.
And it's a long trip, and it's a hard trip. They're carrying the wounded on these, stretchers or kind of like almost like little bamboo cages. One guy's sitting up. And they're just being jolted. It's very difficult. And the trip is too hard for the wounded men. They have to stop along the way. And there they meet young Dr. Chung's father, also a doctor, also Dr. Chung, of course. And there's also a British missionary couple, and they help them out. And they find out that one other crew, led by a Lieutenant Smith, has been rescued and is coming to them. And they're on their way. The crew has an American Army doctor, Doc White. And then a Japanese Zero flies overhead. But there's no damage to the men. Lawson tells his crewman who can to go on without him, and they do, again, singing our favorite song, Deep in the Heart of Texas. Lieutenant Smith's crew arrives and greets Lawson's remaining men. Lieutenant Smith donates blood to Lawson, and Doc White, though, he looks at Lawson's wound, and he's got gangrene in one of his legs, and it's just too bad. And he says he's going to have to amputate his leg, and he does it. So, that's realism. It's not, they all live happily ever after.
No, I mean, there's consequences, but and we'll get into it in the next film because it goes into a lot more detail, but there were severely awful repercussions on the Chinese people for helping the Doolittle Raiders from the Japanese. There was definitely massive reprisal upon these regions of China. So we'll talk about that in a little
bit. Yeah, they don't really show that in this movie, but
we
have to do more than one movie.
Well, and also they're still fighting a war. And so, the other film about the Doolittle Raiders that came out around the same time, Purple Heart, because it did go into, was much more anti-Japanese propaganda. And so the Japanese are portrayed pretty harshly as monsters. In this film, they're more of a threat than not so much. And I think that helps in the long run in some ways for this film to be, held to a higher pedestal in terms of its treatment of the scenario. So,
And it's also interesting. The Chinese are just heroes. They're just kind and so helpful.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And there's a lot of truth in that,
Right. And there's no differentiation. The rebels, the resistance, we can pretty much assume that they were communists. And we know they were communists, the communist Chinese who helped the Doolittle Raiders get out of China and get to where they needed to be, as much as, cooperating with the nationalists at the Kuomintang. So, there's no political agenda. And I think in the Midway movie, there's a little bit more explicitly that they're Chinese communists, but there's some modern day political reasons for that. So, politics of the time have as much to do with film as anything else, current situation. So, they need to show the Chinese as this virtuous resistance to the Japanese. That is part of the propaganda of this film.
Right. And then they gather up all the crewmen that are left, and the Chinese the Americans are about to leave. So they want to honor them. And so there's a Chinese children's choir that sings the Star Spangled Banner for them in Chinese. It's really touching. I'm surprised they didn't sentencing deep in the heart of Texas, Sean.
Yeah, I know.
And Dr. Chung gives Lawson a priceless gift. It's an ancient family heirloom. The other crewmen are also given gifts. There's one slightly awkward part where this really old man comes in and gives all the crewmen a gift. And Lawson opens up his thing and it's two pairs of, it's one pair, it's two slippers. Mm-hmm. And of course, he only has one foot now. And the poor Chinese guy looks like he's about to cry. He's just so embarrassed. And Lawson, it's touching. He reaches up and, you know, basically holds him and shakes his hand and says, "Don't worry about it." Anyway, the Americans then leave for Chongqing. There, an American plane arrives to take them home. The men then say goodbye to Dr. Chung, the younger Dr. Chung. And on the way back, the pilot lets Lawson fly for a while. And the pilot opens his window. And I was watching this video on YouTube about, you know, like they have all these movies where, or not movies, but like videos where an airplane pilot, a real life Navy pilot evaluates all these movie scenes of flyers and stuff. And I was watching one of those and the cabin was not pressurized, right, Sean? This is an earlier plane. And so you wouldn't want to open your window when you're flying at full altitude, would you?
Well, it depends on how high you get. But if you're flying over the Himalayas, no.
Yeah, I don't know how high they were.
Not at all. Not if you're flying over the Himalayas, but if you're flying, if you're flying at a reasonably low altitude, like if you're flying a C-47, you know, and about to drop paratroopers over Normandy, you could probably have your window open a little bit. Or if you're flying a Catalina flying boat looking for Japanese carriers, yeah, you can have your window open because you're going to be at a lower altitude. But yeah, it would not be wise to open your window at high altitude. I don't know that they would let Lawson have flown the plane.
Yeah, that seemed like a Hollywoodish touch, but.
Yes.
There's, you know, they do things like that in movies. Like another thing is the men have their hats on inside way too much. I'm not saying they constantly did, but that's one thing.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're in the military, my dad used to say this, you take off your cover. That's what they call it, your cover, not your hat, your cover. Remove your cover when you're inside. I'm sure my dad probably saw this movie at some point. He probably.
Yeah, but you know, those Air Corps guys, they could kind of do what they wanted.
Okay. Maybe so.
I mean, they
did that though they were expendable some too. It's like
they took out their stiffeners from their hats and just put their, you know, their headphones over them. Didn't bother to wear a crash helmet or anything in their bombers. So those Air Force, those flyboys, they could, you know, what a way to fight a war.
Such rebels. Anyway, and now we get to the conclusion. They're back in the U.S. and Jimmy Doolittle, who's now a general, that when he got home, they promoted him not one rank, but two ranks. He went straight from lieutenant colonel to brigadier general, skipped colonel altogether.
And actually, everybody was promoted. Everybody
got it. He calls Ellen to tell her Lawson is coming home. Then he visits Lawson personally, telling him that he wants him to stay in the service. That's a touching scene, too, because Lawson is just assuming that he's going to be drummed out of the service because he lost the leg.
Yeah, and he's down in his dumps, and Doolittle kind of gives him the, you got a job to do, soldier, you know.
Right, and I read that Lawson was later made, he served in Santiago, Chile, which is interesting.
He served in the war bond effort for a while he was recovering, and then he was posted to the Air Force liaison office in Chile, but he had continued to have problems with his, because of his injuries, and so he retired from the Air Force. And 1944, and he made money off of this book and this movie because it was a best-selling book. And he was involved in the metal industry after the war and died in 1992, which was almost 50 years to the day after the raid.
So, and then the very last thing is that Ellen walks into the room and they embrace, and there's a little, I guess, I don't know if you would call this humor or not. He forgets that he only has one leg and Lawson is in a wheelchair, but he jumps up to give her a big hug and he falls flat on his face. But she doesn't care. He was really concerned that he didn't want Ellen to see him without a leg. He wanted to not even see her at all until he got a wooden leg to replace his regular leg. But that wasn't possible. She wanted to see him really quickly. And so anyway, it all worked out well. You know, they were married for a very long time. And this is not in the movie, but I want to just mention how the raiders fared. I want to kind of wrap up the Doolittle raid. So there were 16 planes, 5 men per plane, so 80 total airmen. And of the 80, 3 were killed in action, 8 were captured by the Japanese. And of these, sadly, 3 were executed, 1 died in captivity, and 4 were later repatriated. 5 men, 1 crew, or 1 plane, as Sean mentioned, landed in the Soviet Union. Oops. Although they were our allies technically, but the Soviets were neutral in the Pacific theater. They had a peace, a new treaty of neutrality with Japan. And so they interned the Americans for more than a year. And then they allowed them to escape. I have that in quotes because it was, they escaped via Anglo-Soviet occupied Iran with the help of the NKVD, the predecessor of the KGB. So the Soviets wanted to get these guys out. They wanted to free them, but they really couldn't officially. So they
legally, they could
legally. Right.
So they had to escape.
Yeah. They, oh gosh, whoops, they got away. And the remaining 64 men landed in friendly areas in China. So that's pretty good. 64 out of 80.
Yeah.
That's 16 out of, oh, I don't know. I can't 16 out of 20. What is that? It's like 80%. So that's mm-hmm. really good.
Yeah. And a number of them, some of them did stay. I learned that some of them did stay in China. Several of them, I think Bob Gray was one of them, flew over the hump, transport aircraft over the Himalayas to supply China. Some joined part of the AVG, what the Flying Tigers became, which was the American Air Force in China. A number of them, though, especially some of the commanders and the planners, were taken out of the area and they went over to Europe. And so one of the pilots actually was, he served in North Africa and he was shot down in North Africa and he became the inspiration for the Steve McQueen character in The Great Escape because he kept trying to escape from German prison camps and they ended up putting him in solitary confinement and he participated in the historic Great Escape event. So he was a Doolittle Raider. So yeah, after the war, the survivors, they had some very beautiful goblets created for each man, each raider. And every year they'd have a reunion and would turn over a goblet that for anyone that they'd lost in the previous year since the last reunion. And they toasted, they would have a very fancy bottle of cognac they all drank from. And those lasted until 2013. And there was three remaining raiders left and they chose no longer to have their reunions. And the last raider was Doodle's co-pilot, Richard Cole. And he passed away in 2019.
Wow. That's amazing. That's what, 77 years after the raid?
Yeah. 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 He lived incredible. A long time, very long time. But yeah, there's a lot of the material. The Jimmy Doolittle collection is housed at the University of Texas at Dallas at a special collection, an aviation collection. So you have all of his papers and a lot of stuff about the Doolittle Raid is kept there. Obviously, the Museum of the United States Air Force, the Air Force Academy, and the Air and Space Museum all have a lot of information about the Doolittle Raid as well.
All right. Well, we're done with the movie, but now it's time for Sean to discuss the cast's accuracy and to give any final thoughts, final words of wisdom. All right. What do you think about the cast?
Well, the only person that's historical that I really know about. So Bob Larson he doesn't really look like Van Johnson. But so Doolittle is a pet peeve of mine, because if you watch Pearl Harbor and if you've watched the more recent Midway, Jimmy Doolittle, if you've seen a picture of Jimmy Doolittle, he is about 5 foot tall and he's a little bantamweight guy who was completely bald and he looks like a fire plug. And no one has ever accurately captured Jimmy Doolittle because they always cast him as tall and handsome and heroic. Alec Baldwin or...
Yeah, and a big thick head of hair.
Yeah, yeah. And like, no, you don't need that. Like, you really... that's just wrong. Ed Harris would be close, although he's a little too tall, but he would be close. But James Cagney, who's one of the finest actors ever, I love Jimmy Cagney. He actually is relatively close because he's kind of a short, stocky kind of guy and he's older. And so I think he fits a little better than just about anybody, although he still has that hair. He's not bald. So I don't know that anybody was bald, you know, was a movie star in 1944 and was bald. So
right. No, it wouldn't work.
Yeah, but Doolittle had a great career after the raid. He was, like you said, he was promoted two ranks to Brigadier General. They sent him to North Africa where he completely reorganized the Air Force that had just invaded as part of the invasion of North Africa because it was in the shambles. He completely reorganized everything. And then they sent him off to England and he ended up commanding the 8th Air Force from basically early, or maybe January 1944 to the end of the war. And so he really was in command of the 8th Air Force during its major bombing campaign of Germany. And then he turned around and was preparing to go to Japan. They re-equipping the 8th Air Force to B-29s. And they wanted them to go there early. And he said, no, we're not ready. And he said, I will not risk a single life to get there early. So Great pilot, great leader, great
American. When did he die?
Doolittle died.
You stall for time. I'll look it up.
He died in 93. So he
93. Wow. Years
after the raid. Yeah.
Yeah. He was 96. Born in 96.
So I remember when he died.
Almost 100. Wow.
Yeah. I was a freshman in college, but I was a war nerd. So I remember the news about him passing.
Oh, wow. That's what an amazing story. An amazing.
Yeah, you know, amazing life.
Yes.
They should do a movie just about Jimmy Doolittle.
That would be
his
good.
Whole life.
And they need to consult Sean on who to cast. It's like, you've got to approve it. You know, no
Maybe
Alec Baldwin.
Maybe Bryan Cranston might be okay.
Yeah. Or they're going to get somebody shorter, though. I don't know.
Yeah.
All right. Now we come to the point where Sean and I rate the film from 1 to 5 stars with half stars allowed. So I know everybody's just dying to hear this. How many stars are we going to give it? Sean, you go first.
I got to give it 5 stars.
Oh, yeah. All right. Well, it's certainly deserving. I'm going to go with 4.5. I'm just very stingy with 5 stars. I don't know that I'm going to.
I have several 5 stars in this series.
I might give one or two of the movies that, but I'm going to dock it half a point for some of the cheesy sentimentality. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just not my. I don't like
it. Give me 4.75. How about?
Well, you can't. You gotta.
It really is in the top tier of those World War II movies. So of the wartime movies, it's really hard to find a film that really is better. It is a little slow by today's standards, but that middle sequence, the action sequence itself, is just bonkers.
Yeah, it's amazing. All right, I'm gonna go 4.5. So there we go.
I won't be reviewing the next film as highly. I can tell you that.
What's that now?
I won't be reviewing the next film as highly.
Oh, well, I'm sure you
will. I'll have a qualified score on that.
Sean and I have spent a lot of time talking about next week's movie, and you may have already guessed we're going roughly in chronological order of not when the movies came out, but when the event occurred. So next week we're gonna have the blockbuster, big budget, you know, shoot 'em up, you know, rock 'em, sock 'em. I don't know what to call it. It's pure action flick, and it is fun. And it's called Midway, and it's our newest film in this entire series, 2019. So join us next time as we talk about Midway. I'm really excited about that, and I hope you are too. And watch the movie if you haven't ever seen it, or if you have seen it, rewatch it. It'll make the discussion much more enjoyable. We'll see you next time. Thank you for listening to today's episode. Key Battles of American History is a proud member of the Parthenon Podcast Network, which includes several other podcasts, including History Unplugged by Scott Rank, Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy by Steve Guerra, and This American President by Richard Lim. If you haven't already, I strongly encourage you to check out these great podcasts. If you would like to support this podcast and help it to grow, there are 4 things you can do. First, you could subscribe to the podcast and leave a review on the podcast player of your choice. This helps other people to find the podcast. Ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts are especially helpful. Second, join our Facebook group, American History Fanatics, where we discuss the episodes of this podcast, as well as other topics related to American history. Third, tell as many friends as you can about the show. And fourth, you could join the elite unit called Early's Raiders by going to patreon.com and searching for Key Battles of American History. There are 5 different levels of support to choose from. Each level allows you to have early access to ad-free episodes. Higher levels bring additional benefits, including bonus episodes and even the ability to commission episodes on topics of your choosing. Before I close, I would like to give a shout out to the current members of Early's Raiders. Thanks to Majors Chris C., Brandon Cuckler, Bob McCullough, Melissa Mueller, Doug Pergram, and Jacob Thomason. Captains Ryan Apashian, Blue Ridge 201, Alex Calabrese, Alex Coombs, Jacob Dyke, Grant Holmstrom, Jeff Henley, Stephen James, Mike Leslie, Jose Martinez, Tim Moon, Michael Rollison, David Santee, Michael Severino, Josh Wheatley, and Gregory Works. And lieutenants Patrick Brennan, Sean Burrell, Matthew Christensen, Ronald Cohen, Craig Didier, Roger Douglas, Michael Fain, Scott Hendricks, David Lueza, and Jeff Sabo. I greatly appreciate your support.
Thank you for listening to Key Battles of American History. If you liked this episode, please subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast catcher. And please be sure and spread the word about the show. If you can spare a few minutes, rate and review the show at Apple Podcasts. This greatly helps us to reach more listeners. And for show notes, maps, and further discussion, visit our website at www.keybattlesofamericanhistory.com. Thank you, and we look forward to joining you again in the next episode of Key Battles of American History.